Disc 2. Spade made the growling animal noise in his throat again and sat down on the settee.
How much money have you got?
He asked. The question startled her. Then she pinched her lower lip between her teeth and answered reluctantly.
I have about $500 left.
Give it to me.
She hesitated, looking timidly at him. He made angry gestures with mouth, eyebrows, hands, and shoulders. She went into her bedroom, returning almost immediately with a sheaf of paper money in one hand. He took the money from her, counted it, and said, "There's only 400 here."
"I had to keep some to live on,"
she explained meekly, putting a hand to her breast. "Can't you get any more?"
"No."
"You must have something you can raise money on," he insisted.
"I have some rings, a little jewelry."
"You'll have to hawk them," he said, and held out his hand. "The Remedial's the best place, Mission and Fifth."
She looked pleadingly at him. His yellow-gray eyes were hard and implacable. Slowly she put her hand inside the neck of her dress, brought out a slender roll of bills, and put them in his waiting hand. He smoothed the bills out and counted them. 4 20s, 4 10s, and a 5. He returned 2 of the 10s and the 5 to her. The others he put in his pocket. Then he stood up and said,
"I'm going out and see what I can do for you. I'll be back as soon as I can with the best news I can manage. I'll ring 4 times. Long, short, so you'll know it's me. You needn't go to the door with me. I can let myself out."
He left her standing in the center of the floor, looking after him with dazed blue eyes. Spade went into a reception room whose door bore the legend, Wise, American, and Wise. The red-haired girl at the switchboard said,
"Oh, hello, Mr. Spade."
"Hello, darling," he replied. "Is Sid in?"
He stood beside her with a hand on her plump shoulder while she manipulated a plug and spoke into the mouthpiece.
"Mr. Spade to see you, Mr. Wise."
She looked up at Spade.
"Go right in."
He squeezed her shoulder by way of acknowledgement, crossed the reception room to a dully lighted inner corridor, and passed down the corridor to a frosted glass door at its far end. He opened the frosted glass door and went into an office where a small, olive-skinned man with a tired oval face, under a thin, dark hair dotted with dandruff, sat behind an immense desk on which bales of paper were heaped. The small man flourished a cold cigar stub at Spade and said,
"Pull a chair around. So, Miles got the big one last night."
Neither his tired face nor his rather shrill voice held any emotion.
"Uh-huh. That's what I came in about."
Spade frowned and cleared his throat.
"I think I'm going to have to tell a coroner to go to hell, Sid. Can I hide behind the sanctity of my client's secrets and identities and whatnot, you know, all the same priest and lawyer?"
Sid Wise lifted his shoulders and lowered the ends of his mouth.
"Yeah, why not? An inquest is not a court trial. You can try anyway. You've gotten away with more than that before this."
"I know, but Dundee's getting snotty. Maybe it is a little bit thick this time. Get your hat, Sid, and we'll go see the right people. I want to be safe."
Sid Wise looked at the papers massed on his desk and groaned. But he got up from his chair and went to the closet by the window.
You're a son of a gun, Sammy,"
he said as he took his hat from its hook. Spade returned to his office at 5:10 that evening. Effie Perrin was sitting at his desk reading Time. Spade sat on the desk and asked,
"Anything stirring?"
"Not here."
"You look like you'd swallowed the canary."
He grinned contentedly.
"I think we've got a future. I always had an idea that if Miles would go off and die somewhere, we'd stand a better chance of thriving. Will you take care of sending flowers for me?"
"I did."
"Oh, you're an invaluable angel. How's your woman's intuition today?"
"Why?"
"What do you think of Wonderly?"
"I'm for her,"
the girl replied, without hesitation.
She's got too many names, Spade mused. Wonderly, LeBlanc, and she says the right one's O'Shaughnessy.
"I don't care if she's got all the names in the phone book. That girl is all right, and you know it."
I wonder.
Spade blinked sleepily at Effie Perrin. He chuckled.
"Anyway, she's given up 700 smacks in 2 days, and that's all right."
Effie Perrin sat up straight and said, "Sam, if that girl's in trouble and you let her down or take advantage of it to bleed her, I'll never forgive you. Never have any respect for you as long as I live." Spade smiled unnaturally. Then he frowned. The frown was unnatural. He opened his mouth to speak, but the sound of someone's entrance through the corridor door stopped him. Effie Perrin rose and went into the outer office. Spade took off his hat and sat in his chair. The girl returned with an engraved card. Mr. Joel Cairo. "This guy is queer," she said.
"In with him then, darling," said Spade.
Mr. Joel Cairo was a small-boned, dark man of medium height. His hair was black and smooth and very glossy. His features were Levantine. A square-cut ruby, its sides paralleled by four baguette diamonds, gleamed against the deep green of his cravat. His black coat, cut tight to narrow shoulders, flared a little over slightly plump hips. His trousers fitted his round legs more snugly than was the current fashion. The uppers of his patent leather shoes were hidden by fawn spats. He held a black derby hat in a chamois-gloved hand and came toward Spade with short, mincing, bobbing steps. The fragrance of chypres came with him. Spade inclined his head at his visitor and then at a chair, saying, "Sit down, Mr. Cairo." Cairo bowed elaborately over his hat, said,
"I thank you,"
in a high-pitched, thin voice, and sat down. He sat down primly, crossing his ankles, placing his hat on his knees, and began to draw off his yellow gloves. Spade rocked back in his chair and asked,
"Now, what can I do for you, Mr. Cairo?"
The amiable negligence of his tone, his motion in the chair, were precisely as they had been when he had addressed the same question to Bridget O'Shaughnessy on the previous day. Cairo turned his hat over, dropping his gloves into it, and placed it bottom up on the corner of the desk nearest him. Diamonds twinkled on the second and fourth fingers of his left hand. A ruby that matched the one in his tie, even to the surrounding diamonds, on the third finger of his right hand. His hands were soft and well cared for. Though they were not large, their flaccid bluntness made them seem clumsy. He rubbed his palms together and said over the whispering sound they made,
"May a stranger offer condolences for your partner's unfortunate death."
"Thanks."
"May I ask, Mr. Spade, if there was, as the newspapers inferred, a certain relationship between that unfortunate happening and the death a little later of the man Thursby?"
Spade said nothing in a blank-faced, definite way. Cairo rose and bowed.
"I beg your pardon."
He sat down and placed his hands side by side, palms down, on the corner of the desk.
"More than idle curiosity made me ask that, Mr. Spade. I am trying to recover an ornament that has been, shall we say, mislaid. I thought and hoped you could assist me."
Spade nodded with eyebrows lifted to indicate a tentativeness.
"The ornament is a statuette,"
Cairo went on, selecting and mouthing his words carefully.
"The black figure of a bird."
Spade nodded again with courteous interest.
"I am prepared to pay on behalf of the figure's rightful owner the sum of $5,000 for its recovery."
Cairo raised one hand from the desk corner and touched a spot in the air with the broad nailed tip of an ugly forefinger.
"I am prepared to promise that, what is the phrase, no questions would be asked?"
He put his hand on the desk again beside the other and smiled blandly over them at the private detective.
"$5,000 is a lot of money," Spade commented, looking thoughtfully at Cairo.
Fingers drummed lightly on the door. When Spade had called,
"Come in,"
the door opened far enough to admit Effie Perrin's head and shoulders. She had put on a small, dark felt hat and a dark coat with a gray fur collar.
"Is there anything else?" she asked.
"Nah. Good night. Lock the door when you go, will you?"
"Good night,"
she said, and disappeared behind the closing door. Spade turned in his chair to face Cairo again, saying,
"It's an interesting figure."
The sound of the corridor doors closing behind Effie Perrin came to them. Cairo smiled and took a short, compact, flat black pistol out of an inner pocket.
"You will please," he said, "clasp your hands together at the back of your neck."
The Levantine. Spade did not look at the pistol. He raised his arms and, leaning back in his chair, intertwined the fingers of his two hands behind his head. His eyes, holding no particular expression, remained focused on Cairo's dark face. Cairo coughed a little apologetic cough and smiled nervously with lips that had lost some of their redness. His dark eyes were humid and bashful and very earnest.
"I intend to search your offices, Mr. Spade. I warn you that if you attempt to prevent me, I shall certainly shoot you."
"Go ahead."
Spade's voice was as empty of expression as his face.
"You will please stand,"
the man with the pistol instructed him, at whose thick chest the pistol was aimed.
"I shall have to make sure you are not armed."
Spade stood up, pushing his chair back with his calves as he straightened his legs. Cairo went around behind him. He transferred the pistol from his right hand to his left. He lifted Spade's coattail and looked under it. Holding the pistol close to Spade's back, he put his right hand around Spade's side and patted his chest. The Levantine face was then no more than 6 inches below and behind Spade's right elbow. Spade's elbow dropped as Spade spun to the right. Cairo's face jerked back, not far enough. Spade's right heel on the patent leather toes anchored the smaller man in the elbow's path. The elbow struck him beneath the cheekbone, staggering him so that he must have fallen had he not been held by Spade's foot on his foot. Spade's elbow went on past the astonished dark face and straightened when Spade's hand struck down at the pistol. Cairo let the pistol go the instant that Spade's fingers touched it. The pistol was small in Spade's hand. Spade took his foot off Cairo's to complete his about-face. With his left hand, Spade gathered together the smaller man's coat lapels, the ruby-set green tie bunching out over his knuckles, while his right hand stowed the captured weapon away in a coat pocket. Spade's yellow-gray eyes were somber. His face was wooden, with a trace of sullenness around the mouth. Cairo's face was twisted by pain and chagrin. There were tears in his dark eyes. His skin was the complexion of polished lead, except where the elbow had reddened his cheek. Spade, by means of his grip on the Levantine's lapels, turned him slowly and pushed him back until he was standing close in front of the chair he had lately occupied. A puzzled look replaced the look of pain in the lead-colored face. Then Spade smiled. His smile was gentle, even dreamy. His right shoulder raised a few inches. His bent right arm was driven up by the shoulder's lift. Fist, wrist, forearm, crooked elbow, and upper arm seemed all one rigid piece, with only the limber shoulder giving them motion. The fist struck Cairo's face, covering for a moment one side of his chin, a corner of his mouth, and most of his cheek between cheekbone and jawbone. Cairo shut his eyes and was unconscious. Spade lowered the limp body into the chair where it lay with sprawled arms and legs, the head lolling back against the chair back, the mouth open. Spade emptied the unconscious man's pockets one by one, working methodically, moving the lax body when necessary, making a pile of the pocket's contents on the desk. When the last pocket had been turned out, he returned to his own chair, rolled and lighted a cigarette, and began to examine his spoils. He examined them with grave, unhurried thoroughness. There was a large wallet of dark, soft leather. The wallet contained $365 in United States bills of several sizes. 3 5-pound notes, a much-visaed Greek passport bearing Cairo's name and portrait, 5 folded sheets of pinkish onion-skin paper covered with what seemed to be Arabic writing, a raggedly clipped newspaper account of the finding of Archer's and Thursby's bodies, a postcard photograph of a dusky woman with bold, cruel eyes and a tender, drooping mouth, a large silk handkerchief, yellow with age and somewhat cracked along its folds, a thin sheaf of Mr. Joel Cairo's engraved cards, and a ticket for an orchestra seat at the Geary Theater that evening. Besides the wallet and its contents, there were three gaily colored silk handkerchiefs, fragrant of Kypres, a platinum Longines watch on a platinum and red gold chain, attached at the other end to a small pear-shaped pendant of some white metal, a handful of United States, British, French, and Chinese coins, a ring holding half a dozen keys, a silver and onyx fountain pen, a metal comb in a leatherette case, a nail file in a leatherette case, a small street guide to San Francisco, a Southern Pacific baggage check, a half-filled package of violet pastilles, a Shanghai insurance broker's business card, and four sheets of Hotel Belvedere writing paper, on one of which was written in small, precise letters, Samuel Spade's name and the addresses of his office and his apartment. Having examined these articles carefully, he even opened the back of the watch case to see that nothing was hidden inside, Spade leaned over and took the unconscious man's wrist between finger and thumb, feeling his pulse. Then he dropped the wrist, settled back in his chair, and rolled and lighted another cigarette. His face, while he smoked, was, except for occasional slight and aimless movements of his lower lip, so still and reflective that it seemed stupid. But when Cairo presently moaned and fluttered his eyelids, Spade's face became bland, and he put the beginning of a friendly smile into his eyes and mouth. Joel Cairo awakened slowly. His eyes opened first, but a full minute passed before they fixed their gaze on any definite part of the ceiling. Then he shut his mouth and swallowed, exhaling heavily through his nose afterwards. He drew in one foot and turned a hand over on his thigh. Then he raised his head from the chair back, looked around the office in confusion, saw Spade, and sat up. He opened his mouth to speak, started, clapped a hand to his face where Spade's fist had struck, and where there was now a florid bruise. Cairo said through his teeth, painfully,
"I couldn't have shot you, Mr. Spade."
"You could have tried," Spade conceded.
"I did not try."
"I know."
"Then why did you strike me after I was disarmed?"
Sorry, Spade said, and grinned wolfishly, showing his jaw teeth. "But imagine my embarrassment when I found that $5,000 offer was just hooey."
"Oh, you are mistaken, Mr. Spade. That was and is a genuine offer."
"What the hell?" Spade's surprise was genuine.
"I am prepared to pay $5,000 for the figure's return."
Cairo took his hand away from his bruised face and sat up, prim and businesslike again.
"You have it?"
"No."
"If it is not here..."
Cairo was very politely skeptical.
"Why should you have risked serious injury to prevent my searching for it?"
"I should sit around and let people come in and stick me up." Spade flicked a finger at Cairo's possessions on the desk. "You've got my apartment address. Been up there yet?"
"Yes, Mr. Spade. I am ready to pay $5,000 for the figure's return, but surely it is natural enough that I should try first to spare the owner that expense if possible."
"Who is he?" Cairo shook his head and smiled.
"You will have to forgive my not answering that question."
"Will I?" Spade leaned forward, smiling with tight lips. "I've got you by the neck, Cairo. You've walked in and tied yourself up plenty strong enough to suit the police with last night's killings. Well, now you'll have to play with me or else." Cairo's smile was demure and not in any way alarmed.
"I made somewhat extensive inquiries about you before taking any action," he said, "and was assured that you were far too reasonable to allow other considerations to interfere with profitable business relations."
Spade shrugged. "Where are they?" he asked.
"I have offered you $5,000 for..."
Spade thumped Cairo's wallet with the backs of his fingers and said, "There's nothing like $5,000 here. You're betting your eyes. You could come in and say you'd pay me $1 million for a purple elephant. What in the hell will that mean?"
I see.
Cairo said thoughtfully, screwing up his eyes.
"You wish some assurance of my sincerity."
He brushed his red lower lip with a fingertip.
A retainer? Would that serve?
It might. Cairo put his hand out towards his wallet, hesitated, withdrew the hand, and said,
You will take, say, $100?
Spade picked up the wallet and took out $100. Then he frowned, said, Better make it 200, and did. Cairo said nothing. Your first guess was that I had the bird, Spade said in a crisp voice when he had put the $200 into his pocket and had dropped the wallet on the desk again. There's nothing in that. What's your second?
That you know where it is, or if not exactly that, that you know it is where you can get it.
Spade neither denied nor affirmed that. He seemed hardly to have heard it. He asked, What sort of proof can you give me that your man is the owner?
Very little, unfortunately. There is this, though. Nobody else can give you any authentic evidence of ownership at all. And if you know as much about the affairs, I suppose, or I should not be here, you know that the means by which it was taken from him shows that his righthood was more valid than anyone else's. Certainly more valid than Thursby's.
What about his daughter? Spade asked. Excitement opened Cairo's eyes and mouth, turned his face red, made his voice shrill.
He is not the owner!
Spade said, mildly and ambiguously.
Is he here, in San Francisco now?
Cairo asked, in a less shrill but still excited voice. Spade blinked his eyes sleepily and suggested,
It might be better all around if we put our cards on the table,
Cairo recovered composure with a little jerk.
I do not think it would be better.
His voice was suave now.
If you know more than I shall profit by your knowledge, and so will you to the extent of $5,000. If you do not, then I have made a mistake in coming to you, and to do as you suggest would be simply to make that mistake worse.
Spade nodded indifferently and waved his hand at the articles on the desk, saying,
There's your stuff.
And then, when Cairo was returning them to his pockets,
It's understood that you're to pay my expenses while I'm getting this black bird for you, and $5,000 when it's done?
Yes, Mr. Spade. That is, $5,000 less whatever monies have been advanced to you. $5,000 in all.
Right. And it's a legitimate proposition.
Spade's face was solemn except for wrinkles at the corners of his eyes.
You're not hiring me to do any murders or burglaries for you, but simply to get it back, if possible, in an honest and lawful way.
If possible,
Cairo agreed. His face also was solemn, except for the eyes.
And in any event, with discretion.
He rose and picked up his hat.
I am at the Hotel Belvedere when you wish to communicate with me. Room 635. I confidently expect the greatest mutual benefit from our association, Mr. Spade.
He hesitated.
May I have my pistol?
Oh, sure. I'd forgotten it.
Spade took the pistol out of his coat pocket and handed it to Cairo. Cairo pointed the pistol at Spade's chest.
You will please keep your hands on top of the desk.
Cairo said earnestly.
I intend to search your offices.
Spade said,
I'll be damned.
Then he laughed in his throat and said,
All right. Go ahead, I won't stop you.
The Undersized Shadow. For half an hour after Joel Cairo had gone, Spade sat alone, still and frowning at his desk. Then he said aloud in the tone of one dismissing a problem,
Well, they're paying for it,
and took a bottle of Manhattan cocktail and a paper drinking cup from a desk drawer. He filled the cup 2/3 full, drank, returned the bottle to the drawer, tossed the cup into the wastebasket, put on his hat and overcoat, turned off the lights, and went down to the night-lit street. An undersized youth of 20 or 21, in neat gray cap and overcoat, was standing idly on the corner below Spade's building. Spade walked up Sutter Street to Kearney,
where he entered a cigar store to buy two sacks of Bull Durham. When he came out, the youth was one of four people waiting for a streetcar on the opposite corner. Spade ate dinner at Herbert's Grill in Powell Street. When he left the grill, at 7:45, the youth was looking into a nearby haberdasher's window. Spade went to the Hotel Belvedere, asking at the desk for Mr. Cairo. He was told that Cairo was not in. The youth sat in a chair in a far corner of the lobby. Spade went to the Geary Theater, failed to see Cairo in the lobby, and posted himself on the curb in front, facing the theater. The youth loitered with other loiterers before Marcard's restaurant below. At 8:10, Joel Cairo appeared, walking up Geary Street with his little, mincing, bobbing steps. Apparently, he did not see Spade until the private detective touched his shoulder. He seemed moderately surprised for a moment, and then said,
"Oh, yes, of course, you saw the ticket."
"Uh-huh. I got something I want to show you."
Spade drew Cairo back towards the curb a little away from the other waiting theatergoers.
"The kid in the cab down by Marcard's."
Cairo murmured,
"I'll see,"
and looked at his watch. He looked up Geary Street. He looked at a theater sign in front of him on which George Arliss was shown costumed as Shylock. And then his dark eyes crawled sidewise in their sockets until they were looking at the kid in the cap, at his cool, pale face with curling lashes hiding lowered eyes.
"Who is he?" Spade asked.
Cairo smiled up at Spade.
"I do not know him."
"He's been tailing me around town."
Cairo wet his lower lip with his tongue and asked,
"Do you think it was wise, then, to let him see us together?"
"How do I know?" Spade replied. "Anyway, it's done."
Cairo removed his hat and smoothed his hair with a gloved hand. He replaced his hat carefully on his head and said, with every appearance of candor,
"I give you my word I do not know him, Mr. Spade. I give you my word I have nothing to do with him. I have asked nobody's assistance except yours, on my word of honor."
"Then he's one of the others?"
"That may be."
"I just want to know, because if he gets to be a nuisance, I may have to hurt him."
"Do as you think best. He's not a friend of mine."
"That's good. There goes the curtain." "Good night," Spade said,
and crossed the street to board a westbound streetcar. The youth in the cap boarded the same car. Spade left the card at Hyde Street and went up to his apartment. His rooms were not greatly upset, but showed unmistakable signs of having been searched. When Spade had washed and put on a fresh shirt and collar, he went out again, walked up to Sutter Street, and boarded a westbound car. The youth boarded it also. Within half a dozen blocks of the Coronet, Spade left the car and went into the vestibule of a tall brown apartment building. He pressed three bell buttons together. The street door lock buzzed. He entered, passed the elevator and stairs, went down a long yellow-walled corridor to the rear of the building, found a back door fastened by a Yale lock, and let himself out into a narrow court. The court led to a dark back street, up which Spade walked for two blocks. Then he crossed over California Street and went to the Coronet. It was not quite 9:30. The eagerness with which Bridget O'Shaughnessy welcomed Spade suggested that she had not been entirely certain of his coming. She had put on a satin gown of the blue shade called Artois that season, with chalcedony shoulder straps, and her stockings and slippers were Artois. The red and cream sitting room had been brought to order and livened with flowers and squat pottery vases of black and silver. Three small, rough-barked logs burned in the fireplace. Spade watched them burn while she put away his hat and coat.
"Do you bring me good news?"
she asked when she came into the room again. Anxiety looked through her smile, and she held her breath.
"We won't have to make anything public that hasn't already been made public."
"The police won't have to know about me?"
"Nope."
She sighed happily and sat on the walnut settee. Her face relaxed and her body relaxed. She smiled up at him with admiring eyes.
"However did you manage it?"
she asked, more in wonder than in curiosity.
Most things in San Francisco can be bought or taken.
And you won't get into trouble? Oh, do sit down.
She made room for him on the settee.
I don't mind a reasonable amount of trouble, he said, with not too much complacence.
He stood beside the fireplace and looked at her with eyes that studied, weighed, judged her without pretense that they were not studying, weighing, judging her. She flushed slightly under the frankness of his scrutiny, but she seemed more sure of herself than before, though a becoming shyness had not left her eyes. He stood there until it seemed plain that he meant to ignore her invitation to sit beside her, and then crossed to the settee.
"You aren't," he asked as he sat down, "exactly the sort of person you pretend to be, are you?"
"I'm not sure I know what you mean," she said in her hushed voice, looking at him with puzzled eyes.
"Schoolgirl manner," he explained, "stammering and blushing and all that."
She blushed and replied hurriedly, not looking at him.
"I told you this afternoon that I've been bad, worse than you could know."
"That's what I mean," he said. "You told me that this afternoon in the same words, same tone. It's a speech you've practiced."
After a moment in which she seemed confused, almost to the point of tears, she laughed and said,
"Very well, then, Mr. Spade. I'm not at all the sort of person I pretend to be. I'm 80 years old, incredibly wicked, and an iron molder by trade. But if I suppose... is one I've grown into. So you won't expect me to drop it entirely, will you?
"Oh, it's all right," he assured her. "Only it wouldn't be all right if you were actually that innocent. We'd never get anywhere."
"I won't be innocent," she promised, with a hand on her heart.
"I saw Joel Cairo tonight," he said in the manner of one making polite conversation.
Gaiety went out of her face. Her eyes, focused on his profile, became frightened and cautious. He had stretched his legs out and was looking at his crossed feet. His face did not indicate that he was thinking about anything. There was a long pause before she asked uneasily,
You know him?"
"I saw him tonight."
Spade did not look up, and he maintained his light conversational tone.
"He was going to see George Arliss."
"You mean you talked to him?"
"Only for a minute or two, till the curtain bell rang."
She got up from the settee and went to the fireplace to poke the fire. She changed slightly the position of an ornament on the mantelpiece, crossed the room to get a box of cigarettes from a table in a corner, straightened a curtain, and returned to her seat. Her face now was smooth and unworried. Spade grinned sidewise at her and said,
"You're good. You're very good."
Her face did not change. She asked quietly,
"What did he say?"
"About what?"
She hesitated.
"About me."
"Nothing."
Spade turned to hold his lighter under the end of her cigarette. His eyes were shiny in a wooden Satan's face.
"Well, what did he say?"
she asked with a half-playful petulance.
"He offered me $5,000 for the Black Bird."
She started. Her teeth tore the end of her cigarette, and her eyes, after a swift, alarmed glance at Spade, turned away from him.
"You're not going to go around poking at the fire and straighten up the room again, are you?"
he asked lazily. She laughed a clear, merry laugh, dropped the mangled cigarette into a tray, and looked at him with clear, merry eyes.
"I won't," she promised. "And what did you say?"
$5,000 is a lot of money."
She smiled, but when, instead of smiling, he looked gravely at her, her smile became faint, confused, and presently vanished. In its place came a hurt, bewildered look.
"Surely you're not really considering it," she said.
"Why not? $5,000 is a lot of money."
"But, Mr. Spade, you promised to help me."
Her hands were on his arm.
"I trusted you. You can't..."
She broke off, took her hands from his sleeve, and worked them together. Spade smiled gently into her troubled eyes.
"Don't let's try to figure out how much you've trusted me," he said. I promised to help you, sure, but you didn't say anything about any black birds.
But you must have known, or you wouldn't have mentioned it to me. You do know now. You can't treat me like that.
Her eyes were cobalt blue prayers.
$5,000 is, he said for the third time, a lot of money.
She lifted her shoulders and hands and let them fall in a gesture that accepted defeat.
It is,
she agreed in a small, dull voice.
It is far more than I could ever offer you, if I must bid for your loyalty.
Spade laughed. His laughter was brief and somewhat bitter.
That is good, he said. Coming from you. What have you given me besides money? Have you given me any of your confidence, any of the truth, any help in helping you? Haven't you tried to buy my loyalty with money and nothing else? Well, if I'm peddling it, why shouldn't I let it go to the highest bidder?
I've given you all the money I have.
Tears glistened in her white ringed eyes. Her voice was hoarse, vibrant.
I have thrown myself on your mercy. Told you that without your help, I'm utterly lost. What else is there?
She suddenly moved close to him on the settee and cried angrily,
Can I buy you with my body?
Their faces were a few inches apart. Spade took her face between his hands and he kissed her mouth roughly and contemptuously. Then he sat back and said,
I'll think it over.
His face was hard and furious. She sat still, holding her numb face where his hands had left it. He stood up and said,
Oh, Christ! There's no sense to this!
He took two steps towards the fireplace and stopped, glowering at the burning logs, grinding his teeth together. She did not move. He turned to face her. The two vertical lines above his nose were deep clefts between red wheels.
I don't give a damn about your honesty, he told her, trying to make himself speak calmly. I don't care what kind of tricks you're up to, what your secrets are, but I've got to have something to show you know what you're doing.
I do know. Please believe that I do, and that is all for the best.
Show me, he ordered. I'm willing to help you. I've done what I could so far. If necessary, I'll go ahead blindfolded, but I can't do it without more confidence in you than I've got now. You've got to convince me that you know what it's all about. You're not simply fiddling around by guess and by God, hoping it'll come out all right somehow in the end.
Can't you trust me just a little longer?
How much is a little? And what are you waiting for?
She bit her lip and looked down.
I must talk to Joel Cairo,
she said, almost inaudibly.
Yeah, you can see him tonight, Spade said, looking at his watch. His show will be out soon. We can get him on the phone at his hotel.
She raised her eyes, alarmed.
But he can't come here. I can't let him know where I am. I'm afraid.
My place, Spade suggested.
She hesitated, working her lips together, then asked,
Do you think he'd go there?
Spade nodded.
All right,
she exclaimed, jumping up, her eyes large and bright.
Shall we go now?
She went into the next room. Spade went to the table in the corner and silently pulled the drawer out. The drawer held two packs of playing cards, a pad of scorecards for bridge, a brass screw, a piece of red string, a gold pencil. He had shut the drawer and was lighting a cigarette when she returned, wearing a small dark hat and a gray kidskin coat, carrying his hat and coat. Their taxi cab drew up behind a dark sedan that stood directly in front of Spade's street door. Iva Archer was alone in the sedan, sitting at the wheel. Spade lifted his hat to her and went indoors with Bridget O'Shaughnessy. In the lobby, he halted beside one of the benches and asked, Do you mind waiting here for a moment? I won't be long.
That's perfectly all right,
Bridget O'Shaughnessy said, sitting down.
You needn't hurry.
Spade went out to the sedan. When he had opened the sedan's door, Iva spoke quickly.
I've got to talk to you, Sam. Can I come in?
Her face was pale and nervous.
Not now.
Iva clicked her teeth together and asked sharply,
Who is she?
I've only a minute, Iva, Spade said patiently. What is it?
Who is she?
she repeated, nodding at the street door. He looked away from her, down the street. In front of a garage on the next corner, an undersized youth of 20 or 21, in neat gray cap and overcoat, loafed with his back against a wall. Spade frowned and returned his gaze to Iva's insistent face. "What is the matter?" he asked. "Has anything happened? You oughtn't to be here at this time of night."
"I'm beginning to believe that," she complained. "You told me I oughtn't to come to the office. Now I oughtn't to come here. Do you mean I oughtn't to chase after you? If that's what you mean, why don't you say right out?"
"Now, Iva, you've got no right to take that attitude."
"I know I haven't. I haven't any rights at all, it seems, where you're concerned. I thought I had. I thought you were pretending to love me, gave me..."
Spade said wearily, "This is no time to be arguing about that, Precious. What was it you wanted to see me about?"
"I can't talk to you here, Sam. Can I come in?"
"Not now."
"Why can't I?"
Spade said nothing. She made a thin line of her mouth, squirmed around straight behind the wheel, and started the sedan's engine, staring angrily ahead. When the sedan began to move, Spade said, "Good night, Iva," shut the door, and stood at the curb with his hat in his hand until it had been driven away. Then he went indoors again. Bridget O'Shaughnessy rose, smiling cheerfully, from the bench, and they went up to his apartment. G in the Air. In his bedroom, that was a living room, now the wall bed was up, Spade took Bridget O'Shaughnessy's hat and coat, made her comfortable in a padded rocking chair, and telephoned the Hotel Belvedere. Cairo had not returned from the theater. Spade left his telephone number with a request that Cairo call him as soon as he came in. Spade sat down in the armchair beside the table and without any preliminary, without an introductory remark of any sort, began to tell the girl about a thing that had happened some years before in the Northwest. He talked in a steady, matter-of-fact voice that was devoid of emphasis or pauses, though now and then he repeated a sentence slightly rearranged, as if it were important that each detail be related exactly as it had happened. At the beginning, Bridget O'Shaughnessy listened with only partial attentiveness, obviously more surprised by his telling the story than interested in it, her curiosity more engaged with his purpose in telling the story than with the story he told. But presently, as the story went on, it caught her more and more fully, and she became still and receptive. A man named Flitcraft had left his real estate office in Tacoma to go to luncheon one day and had never returned. He did not keep an engagement to play golf after 4 that afternoon, though he had taken the initiative in making the engagement less than half an hour before he went out to luncheon. His wife and children never saw him again. His wife and he were supposed to be on the best of terms. He had 2 children, boys, 1 5 and the other 3. He owned his house in a Tacoma suburb, a new Packard, and the rest of the appurtenances of successful American living. Flitcraft had inherited $70,000 from his father, and, with his success in real estate, was worth something in the neighborhood of $200,000 at the time he vanished. His affairs were in order, though there were enough loose ends to indicate that he had not been setting them in order preparatory to vanishing. A deal that would have brought him an attractive profit, for instance, was to have been concluded the day after the one on which he disappeared. There was nothing to suggest that he had more than $50 or $60 in his immediate possession at the time of his going. His habits for months past could be accounted for too thoroughly to justify any suspicion of secret vices, or even of another woman in his life, though either was barely possible. "It went like that," Spade said, "like a fist when you open your hand." When he had reached this point in his story, the telephone bell rang.
"Hello?"
Spade said into the instrument.
"Mr. Cairo, this is Spade. Can you come up to my place? Post Street. Now?" "Yes, I think it is."
He looked at the girl, pursed his lips, and then said rapidly,
"Miss O'Shaughnessy is here and wants to see you."
Bridget O'Shaughnessy frowned and stirred in her chair, but did not say anything. Spade put the telephone down and told her,
"He'll be up in a few minutes." "Well, that was in 1922. In 1927, I was with one of the big detective agencies in Seattle. Mrs. Flitcroft came in and told us somebody had seen a man in Spokane who looked a lot like her husband. I went over there. It was Flitcroft, all right. He had been living in Spokane for a couple of years as Charles, that was his first name, Pierce. He had an automobile business that was netting him $20,000 or $25,000 a year, a wife, a baby son, owned his home in a Spokane suburb, and usually got away to play golf after 4 p.m. during the season. Spade had not been told very definitely what to do when he found Flitcroft. They talked in Spade's room at the Davenport. Flitcroft had no feeling of guilt. He had left his first family well provided for, and what he had done seemed to him perfectly reasonable. The only thing that bothered him was a doubt that he could make that reasonableness clear to Spade. He had never told anybody his story before, and thus had not had to attempt to make his reasonableness explicit. He tried now. "I got it all right," Spade told Bridget O'Shaughnessy. But Mrs. Flitcroft never did. She thought it was silly. Maybe it was. Anyway, it came out all right. She didn't want any scandal, and after the trick he had played on her, the way she looked at it, she didn't want him. So they were divorced on the quiet, and everything was swell all around. Here's what happened to him. Going to lunch, he passed an office building that was being put up, just a skeleton. A beam or something fell 8 or 10 stories down and smacked the sidewalk alongside him. It brushed pretty close to him, but didn't touch him, though a piece of the sidewalk was chipped off and flew up and hit his cheek. It only took a piece of skin off, but he still had a scar when I saw him. He rubbed it with his finger, well, affectionately, when he told me about it. He was scared stiff, of course, he said, but he was more shocked than really frightened. It felt like somebody had taken the lid off life and let him look at the works. Flitcroft had been a good citizen and a good husband and father. Not by any outer compulsion, but simply because he was a man who was most comfortable in step with his surroundings. He'd been raised that way. The people he knew were like that. The life he knew was a clean, orderly, sane, responsible affair. Now a falling beam had shown him that life was fundamentally none of these things. He, the good citizen, husband, father, could be wiped out between office and restaurant by the accident of a falling beam. He knew then that men died at haphazard like that, and lived only while blind chance spared them. It was not primarily the injustice of it that disturbed him. He accepted that after the first shock. What disturbed him was the discovery that in sensibly ordering his affairs, he had got out of step, and not into step, with life. He said he knew before he had gone 20 feet from the fallen beam that he would never know peace again until he had adjusted himself to this new glimpse of life. By the time he had eaten his luncheon, he had found his means of adjustment. Life could be ended for him at random by a falling beam. He would change his life at random by simply going away. He loved his family, he said, as much as he supposed was usual, but he knew he was leaving them adequately provided for, and his love for them was not of the sort that would make absence painful. "He went to Seattle that afternoon," Spade said, "and from there by boat to San Francisco. For a couple of years he wandered around and then drifted back to the Northwest and settled in Spokane and got married. His second wife didn't look like the first, but they were more alike than they were different. You know, the kind of women that play fair games of golf and bridge and like new salad recipes. He wasn't sorry for what he had done. It seemed reasonable enough to him. I don't think he even knew he had settled back naturally into the same groove he had jumped out of in Tacoma. But that's the part of it I always liked. He adjusted himself to beams falling, and then no more of them fell, and he adjusted himself to them not falling."
"How perfectly fascinating," Bridget O'Shaughnessy said.
She left her chair and stood in front of him, close. Her eyes were wide and deep.
"I don't have to tell you how utterly at a disadvantage you'll have me with him here, if you choose."
Spade smiled slightly without separating his lips. "No, you don't have to tell me," he agreed.
"And you know, I'd never have placed myself in this position if I hadn't trusted you completely."
Her thumb and forefinger twisted a black button on his blue coat. Spade said, "That again," with mock resignation.
But you know it's so,
she insisted. No, I don't know it. He patted the hand that was twisting the button. My asking for reasons why I should trust you brought us here. Don't let us confuse things. You don't have to trust me anyhow as long as you can persuade me to trust you. She studied his face. Her nostrils quivered. Spade laughed. He patted her hand again and said, Don't worry about that now. He'll be here in a moment. Get your business with him over and then we'll see how we'll stand.
And you'll let me go about it? With him? In my own way?
Sure. She turned her hand under his so that her fingers pressed his. She said softly,
You're a godsend.
Spade said, Don't overdo it. She looked reproachfully at him, though smiling, and returned to the padded rocker. Joel Cairo was excited. His dark eyes seemed all irises, and his high-pitched, thin-voiced words were tumbling out before Spade had the door half open.
That boy is out there watching the house, Mr. Spade. That boy you showed me, or to whom you showed me, in front of the theater. What am I to understand from that, Mr. Spade? I came here in good faith with no thought of tricks or traps.
You were asked in good faith. Spade frowned thoughtfully. But I ought to have guessed he might show up. He saw you come in?
Naturally. I could have gone on, but that seemed useless, since you had already let him see us together.
Bridget O'Shaughnessy came into the passageway behind Spade and asked anxiously,
What boy? What is it?
Cairo removed his black hat from his head, bowed stiffly, and said in a prim voice,
If you do not know, ask Mr. Spade. I know nothing about it except through him.
The kid has been trying to tail me around town all evening, Spade said carelessly over his shoulder, not turning to face the girl. Come on in, Cairo. There's no use standing here talking for all the neighbors. Bridget O'Shaughnessy grabbed Spade's arm above the elbow and demanded,
Did he follow you back to my apartment?
Nah, I shook him before that. Then I suppose he came back here to try to pick me up again. Cairo, holding his black hat to his belly with both hands, had come into the passageway. Spade shut the corridor door behind him and they went into the living room. There, Cairo bowed stiffly over his hat once more and said,
I am delighted to see you again, Miss O'Shaughnessy.
I was sure you would be, Joe, she replied, giving him her hand. He made a formal bow over her hand and released it quickly. She sat in the padded rocker she had occupied before. Cairo sat in the armchair by the table. Spade, when he had hung Cairo's hat and coat in the closet, sat on an end of the sofa in front of the windows and began to roll a cigarette. Bridget O'Shaughnessy said to Cairo,
Sam told me about your offer for the Falcon. How soon can you have the money ready?
Cairo's eyebrows twitched. He smiled.
It is ready.
He continued to smile at the girl for a little while after he had spoken, and then looked at Spade. Spade was lighting a cigarette. His face was tranquil.
In cash?
The girl asked.
Oh, yes,
Cairo replied. She frowned, put her tongue between her lips, withdrew it, and asked,
You are ready to give us $5,000 now if we give you the Falcon.
Cairo held up a wriggling hand.
Excuse me,
he said.
I expressed myself badly. I did not mean to say that I have the money in my pockets, but that I am prepared to get it on a very few minutes' notice at any time during banking hours.
Oh?
She looked at Spade. Spade blew cigarette smoke down the front of his vest and said, That's probably right. He had only a few hundred in his pockets when I frisked him this afternoon. When her eyes opened wide and round, he grinned. The Levantine bent forward in his chair. He failed to keep eagerness from showing in his eyes and voice.
I can be quite prepared to give you the money at, say, 10:30 in the morning?
Bridget O'Shaughnessy smiled at him and said,
But I haven't got the Falcon.
Cairo's face was darkened by a flush of annoyance. He put an ugly hand on either side of his chair, holding a small boned body erect and stiff between them. His dark eyes were angry. He did not say anything. The girl made a mock placatory face at him.
I'll have it in a week at the most, though, she said.
Where is it?
Cairo used politeness of mien to express skepticism. Where Floyd hit it?
Floyd? Thursby?
She nodded.
And you know where that is?
He asked.
I think I do.
Then why must we wait a week?
Perhaps not a whole week. Whom are you buying it for, Joe?
Cairo raised his eyebrows.
I told Mr. Spade, for its owner.
Surprise illuminated the girl's face.
So you went back to him?
Naturally I did.
She laughed softly in her throat and said,
I should have liked to have seen that.
Cairo shrugged.
That was the logical development.
He rubbed the back of one hand with the palm of the other. His upper lids came down to shade his eyes.
Why, if I in turn may ask a question, are you willing to sell to me?
I'm afraid, she said simply, after what happened to Floyd. That's why I haven't it now. I'm afraid to touch it except to turn it over to somebody else right away.
Spade, propped on an elbow on the sofa, looked at and listened to them impartially. In the comfortable slackness of his body and the easy stillness of his features, there was no indication of either curiosity or impatience.
Exactly what?
Cairo asked in a low voice.
Happened to Floyd?
The tip of Bridget O'Shaughnessy's right forefinger traced a swift G in the air. Cairo said,
I see.
But there was something doubting in his smile.
Is he here?
I don't know. She spoke impatiently. What difference does it make?
The doubt in Cairo's smile deepened.
It might make a world of difference, he said,
and rearranged his hands in his lap so that, intentionally or not, a blunt forefinger pointed at Spade. The girl glanced at the pointing finger and made an impatient motion with her head.
Or me, she said. Or you.
Exactly. And shall we add more certainly the boy outside?
Yes, she agreed and laughed. Yes, unless he's the one you had in Constantinople.
Sudden blood mottled Cairo's face. In a shrill, enraged voice he cried,
The one you couldn't make?
Bridget O'Shaughnessy jumped up from her chair. Her lower lip was between her teeth. Her eyes were dark and wide in a tense white face. She took two quick steps towards Cairo. He started to rise. Her right hand went out and cracked sharply against his cheek, leaving the imprint of fingers there. Cairo grunted and slapped her cheek, staggering her sidewise, bringing from her mouth a brief, muffled scream. Spade, wooden of face, was up from the sofa and close to them by then. He caught Cairo by the throat and shook him. Cairo gurgled and put a hand inside his coat. Spade grasped the Levantine's wrist, wrenched it away from the coat, forced it straight out to the side, and twisted it until the clumsy, flaccid fingers opened to let the black pistol fall down on the rug. Bridget O'Shaughnessy quickly picked up the pistol. Cairo, speaking with difficulty because of the fingers on his throat, said,
This is the second time you've put your hands on me!
His eyes, though the throttling pressure on his throat made them bulge, were cold and menacing.
Yes, Spade growled, and when you're slapped, you'll take it and like it.
He released Cairo's wrist and with a thick, open hand struck the side of his face three times, savagely. Cairo tried to spit in Spade's face, but the dryness of his mouth made it only an angry gesture. Spade slapped the mouth, cutting the lower lip. The doorbell rang. Cairo's eyes jerked into focus on the passageway that led to the corridor door. His eyes had become unangry and wary. The girl had gasped and turned to face the passageway. Her face was frightened. Spade stared gloomily for a moment at the blood trickling from Cairo's lip, and then stepped back, taking his hand from the Levantine's throat.
Who is it?
The girl whispered, coming close to Spade, and Cairo's eyes jerked back to ask the same question. Spade gave his answer irritably.
I don't know.
The bell rang again, more insistently.
Well, keep quiet,
Spade said, and went out of the room, shutting the door behind him. Spade turned on the light in the passageway and opened the door to the corridor. Lieutenant Dundee and Tom Polhouse were there.
Hello, Sam, Tom said. We thought maybe you wouldn't have gone to bed yet.
Dundee nodded, but said nothing. Spade said, good-naturedly, "Oh, you guys pick swell hours to do your visiting in. What is it this time?" Dundee spoke then, quietly.
"We want to talk to you, Spade."
"Well?" Spade stood in the doorway, blocking it. "Go ahead and talk." Tom Polehouse advanced, saying,
We don't have to do it standing here, do we?"
Spade stood in the doorway and said, "You can't come in." His tone was very slightly apologetic. Tom's thick-featured face, even in height with Spade's, took on an expression of friendly scorn, though there was a bright gleam in his small, shrewd eyes.
What the hell, Sam?"
he protested, and put a big hand playfully on Spade's chest. Spade leaned against the pushing hand, grinned wolfishly, and asked, "Going to strong arm me, Tom?" Tom grumbled,
"For God's sake,"
and took his hand away. Dundee clicked his teeth together and said through them,
"Let us in."
Spade's lip twitched over his eye tooth. He said, "You're not coming in. What do you want to do about it? Try to get in, or do your talking here? Or go to hell?" Tom groaned. Dundee, still speaking through his teeth, said,
"It'd pay you to play along with us, little Spade. You've got away with this and you've got away with that, but you can't keep it up forever."
"Stop me when you can," Spade replied arrogantly.
"That's what I'll do."
Dundee put his hands behind him and thrust his hard face up towards the private detectives.
"There's talk going around that you and Archer's wife were cheating on him."
Spade laughed.
"That sounds like something you thought up yourself." "Then there's not anything to it?"
"Not anything."
"The talk is," Dundee said, "that she tried to get a divorce out of him so she could put in with you. But he wouldn't give it to her. Anything to that?" "No." "There's even talk,"
Dundee went on stolidly,
that's why he was put on the spot."
Spade seemed mildly amused.
"Don't be a hog," he said.
"You oughtn't to try to pin more than one murder at a time on me. Your first idea that I knocked Thursby off because he'd killed Miles falls apart if you blame me for killing Miles, too."
"You haven't heard me say you killed anybody,"
Dundee replied.
"You're the one that keeps bringing that up." "But suppose I did. You could have blipped them both, is a way of figuring it."
"Uh-huh. I could have butchered Miles to get his wife, and then Thursby, so I could hang Miles' killing on him. Yeah, that's a hell of a swell system. Will be when I can give somebody else a bump and hang Thursby's on them. How long am I supposed to keep that up, huh? Are you going to put your hand on my shoulder for all the killings in San Francisco from now on?"
Tom said,
Cut the comedy, Sam. You know damn well we don't like this any more than you do. We got our work to do."
"I hope you've got something to do besides pop in here early every morning with a lot of damn fool questions
and get damn lying answers,"
Dundee added deliberately.
"Take it easy," Spade cautioned him.
Dundee looked him up and down, and then looked him straight in the eyes.
"If you say there's nothing between you and Archer's wife," he said, "you're a liar, and I'm telling you so."
A startled look came into Tom's small eyes. Spade moistened his lips with the tip of his tongue and asked,
"Is that the hot tip that brought you here at this ungodly time of night?"
"That's one of them."
"And the others?" Dundee pulled down the corners of his mouth.
"Let us in."
He nodded significantly at the doorway in which Spade stood. Spade frowned and shook his head. Dundee's mouth corners lifted into a smile of grim satisfaction.
"There must have been something to it,"
he told Tom. Tom shifted his feet and, not looking at either man, mumbled,
"Yeah, God knows."
"What's this?"
Spade asked.
"Charades?"
"All right, Spade. We're going."
Dundee buttoned his overcoat.
"We'll be in to see you now and then. Maybe you're right in bucking us. Think it over."
"Uh-huh,"
Spade said, grinning.
"Glad to see you any time, Lieutenant. And whenever I'm not busy, I'll let you in."
A voice in Spade's living room screamed,
"Help! Help! Please! Help!"
The voice, high and thin and shrill, was Joel Cairo's. Lieutenant Dundee stopped turning away from the door confronted Spade again and said decisively,
"I guess we're going in."
The sounds of a brief struggle, of a blow, of a subdued cry came to them. Spade's face twisted into a smile that held little joy. He said,
"I guess you are,"
and stood out of the way. When the police detectives had entered, he shut the corridor door and followed them back to the living room. Horse feathers. Bridget O'Shaughnessy was huddled in the armchair by the table. Her forearms were up over her cheeks, her knees drawn up until they hid the lower part of her face. Her eyes were white-circled and terrified. Joel Cairo stood in front of her, bending over her, holding in one hand the pistol Spade had twisted out of his hand. His other hand was clapped to his forehead. Blood ran through the fingers of that hand and down under them to his eyes. A smaller trickle from his cut lip made three wavy lines across his chin. Cairo did not heed the detectives. He was glaring at the girl huddled in front of him. His lips were working spasmodically, but no coherent sound came from between them. Dundee, the first of the three into the living room, moved swiftly to Cairo's side, put a hand on his own hip under his overcoat, a hand on the Levantine's wrist, and growled,
"What are you up to here?"
Cairo took the red-smeared hand from his head and flourished it close to the lieutenant's face. Uncovered by the hand, his forehead showed a 3-inch ragged tear.
"This is what she has done!" he cried. "Look at it!"
The girl put her feet down on the floor and looked warily from Dundee, holding Cairo's wrist, to Tom Polehouse standing a little behind them, to Spade leaning against the doorframe. Spade's face was placid. When his gaze met hers, his yellow-gray eyes glinted for an instant with malicious humor, and then became expressionless again.
"Did you do that?"
Dundee asked the girl, nodding at Cairo's cut head. She looked at Spade again. He did not in any way respond to the appeal in her eyes. He leaned against the doorframe and observed the occupants of the room with the polite, detached air of a disinterested spectator. The girl turned her eyes up to Dundee's. Her eyes were wide and dark and earnest.
"I had to," she said in a low, throbbing voice. "I was all alone in here with him when he attacked me. I tried to keep him off. I couldn't make myself shoot him."
"Oh, you liar!"
Cairo cried, trying unsuccessfully to pull the arm that held his pistol out of Dundee's grip.
"Oh, you dirty, filthy liar!"
He twisted himself around to face Dundee.
"She's lying awfully. I came here in good faith and was attacked by both of them. And when you came, he went out to talk to you, leaving her here with this pistol. And then she said they were going to kill me after you left. And I called for help so you wouldn't leave me here to be murdered. And then she struck me with the pistol."
"Here, give me the thing,"
Dundee said, and took the pistol from Cairo's hand.
"Now let's get this straight. What'd you come here for?"
"He sent for me."
Cairo twisted his head around to stare defiantly at Spade.
"He called me on the phone and asked me to come here."
Spade blinked sleepily at the Levantine and said nothing. Dundee asked,
"What do you want you for?"
Cairo withheld his reply until he had mopped his bloody forehead and chin with a lavender-barred silk handkerchief. By then, some of the indignation in his manner had been replaced by caution.
"He said they wanted to see me. I didn't know what about."
Tom Polehouse lowered his head, sniffed the odor of chypre that the mopping handkerchief had released in the air, and turned his head to scowl interrogatively at Spade. Spade winked at him and went on rolling a cigarette. Dundee asked,
"Well, what happened then?"
"Then they attacked me. She struck me first, and then he choked me and took the pistol out of my pocket. I don't know what they would have done next if you hadn't arrived at that moment. I dare say they would have murdered me then and there. When he went out to answer the bell, he left me here with the pistol to watch over me."
Bridget O'Shaughnessy jumped out of the armchair, crying, "Why don't you make him tell the truth?" and slapped Cairo on the cheek. Cairo yelled inarticulately. Dundee pushed the girl back into the chair with a hand that was not holding the Levantine's arm and growled,
"None of that now."
Spade, lighting a cigarette, grinned softly through smoke and told Tom, "She's impulsive."
"Yeah,"
Tom agreed. Dundee scowled down at the girl and asked,
"What do you want us to think the truth is?"
Not what he said,
she replied.
Not anything he said.
She turned to Spade.
Is it?
How do I know? Spade responded. I was out in the kitchen mixing an omelette when it all happened, wasn't I?
She wrinkled her forehead, studying him with eyes that perplexity clouded. Tom grunted in disgust. Dundee, still scowling at the girl, ignored Spade's speech and asked her,
If he's not telling the truth, how come he did the squawking for help and not you?
Oh, he was frightened to death when I struck him, she replied,
looking contemptuously at the Levantine. Cairo's face flushed where it was not blood-smeared. He exclaimed,
Another lie!
She kicked his leg, the high heel of her blue slipper striking him just below the knee. Dundee pulled him away from her while Big Tom came to stand close to her, rumbling,
Behave, sister, there's no way to act.
Then make him tell the truth, she said defiantly.
We'll do that all right, he promised. Just don't get rough.
Dundee, looking at Spade with green eyes, hard and bright and satisfied, addressed his subordinate.
Well, Tom, I don't guess we'll go wrong pulling the lot of them in.
Tom nodded gloomily. Spade left the door and advanced to the center of the room, dropping his cigarette into a tray on the table as he passed it. His smile and manner were amiably composed.
Don't be in a hurry, he said. Everything can be explained.
Yeah, I bet you,
Dundee agreed, sneering. Spade bowed to the girl.
Miss O'Shaughnessy, he said. May I present Lieutenant Dundee and Detective Sergeant Polehouse?
He bowed to Dundee. Miss O'Shaughnessy is an operative in my employ. Joel Cairo said indignantly,
This isn't so! She...
Spade interrupted him in a quite loud but still genial voice.
I hired her just recently, yesterday. This is Mr. Joel Cairo, a friend, an acquaintance at any rate, of Thursby's. He came to me this afternoon and tried to hire me to find something Thursby was supposed to have on him when he was bumped off. It looked funny the way he put it to me, so I wouldn't touch it. Then he pulled a gun.
Well, never mind that unless it comes to a point of laying charges against each other.
End of Disc 2.